This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, okay. Have we? Oh no, we can't start like this. There's got to be some sense of order. I should have said hello rather than okie dokie. I'm worried I'm going to become one of those old people who just says things like okie dokie. Oh, Ned Flanders, basically, is what I'm going to turn
into. I mean,
into.
I think your twilight career as a host of some dodgy TV game show, then okie dokie is going to be one of your catchphrases. Okie dokie, it's Jan Richardson with Eat the Cake.
I see okie dokie as more of a sidekick, sort of like a sidekick robot when I finally tire of working with human beings as a result of your two constant heckling.
I'll tell you what's going to be worse. We're going to end up being okie dokie, me and Ed. I'll be okie, he'll be dokie.
Yeah, it's time to choose an answer. Will you go with okie or dokie? Is it a big lump of oaky that's stuck in your sluice gate, Ed? We've started, by the way. We're just Series 4, Episode 7. If you don't know who we are by now, then just Google it. Yeah. Or, you know, what are the search engines in Icosia it, since yeah. We're talking about futures?
I think that's Icosia, isn't it?
Icosia.
Yeah.
Because it's Icosia ecosystem.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, that's nice. That makes sense.
But now, to your question, John, is I don't know the strain of wood that is stuck in my sluice.
Still there?
Yeah. It's firmly wedged. It's not going anywhere. Actually, I've got the Environment Agency coming around immediately after this recording this morning. So I can't give you an update today. I know everyone's on tenterhooks because clearly the kind of log wedged in my sluice is a matter of national import.
It's becoming so.
So I'll get the greater clarity on how we might get it loose.
Mm. How's your flow, Mark?
I'd answer that. I'm in a much better mood than I have been recently. So I guess that means my flow is good.
Good, yeah. You're finally getting rid of all your sluice.
Yes, I'm de-logging myself.
Well, we're well into 2023 now. Ed, you stumbled across a theory that your 2023 will be defined by...
Yeah, defined by the song that was number one on your 23rd birthday. I mean, this is obviously one of these completely... nonsense memes, but hey, it's got some comedic potential.
I'm going to go first with mine because I've got nothing to say about it. 2005.
What?
Yeah. That made me feel quite good.
Fucking
just
hell.
That it was in the 2000s made me feel quite good having turned 40 this year.
God, you're so young.
Gold Digger by Kanye. I've just got no comment. Anyone who's familiar with my work will have watched a bit of Meet the Richardsons and can draw their own conclusions.
That song was inspired by the photography of Sebastian Salgado in Latin America.
Was it?
Oh, God, it wasn't.
No. Okay. It would be lovely to think it was.
So what was number one on your 23rd birthday, Mark?
Well, it's something I'm thinking about now. It was actually Without You, the cover by Mariah Carey. And actually, I'm thinking about being Without You too right now.
Oh, that would be quite apt for this year then.
Yes.
Be careful what you wish for. Yeah, mine was Robson and Jerome, Unchained Melody.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, talk about recycled, unimaginative, bland rubbish.
Yeah. Both of ours were covers. And
I was going to say.
John was the original.
Startlingly original.
How are the reviews for your tour going? Are they saying that, startlingly original?
No, the reviews are very middle of the road. I don't think reviewers really know what to do with comedy, unless it's a greatly themed show. If you just tell jokes, as I do, for an hour and a half, they don't really know what to do because there's no real purpose to them. They start off with, well, you know, there's lots of laughs in it. and then they have to write four paragraphs. There's a large section about my hemorrhoid in it. So, you know, there's a limit to how deeply you can interpret a routine about a hemorrhoid.
Well, I went for the truth. I asked ChatGPT what do people say about the British comedian John Richardson. Do you know what the artificial intelligence said about you, John?
No, I suspect I might like this answer better than non-artificial intelligence.
And he said, John Richardson is a British comedian, actor and television presenter known for his observational comedy and deadpan delivery. Critics have generally praised Richardson's stand-up comedy, generally, so not exclusively.
Yeah, that's fair.
Matching his observational style and dry wit. He's been described as brilliantly funny and a master of observational comedy and considered to be one of the best comedians in the United Kingdom.
Wow. Rise of the robots. Long may it continue.
Now, talking about press coverage, there was a very nice profile of you in The Guardian this week where you did an interview. Two things came from that. One, I read the comments and realised why you never do, because there's some real arseholes out there.
Some, just a few.
Just like fucking hell, you know. Yeah, I don't like John Richardson. He doesn't make me laugh. Well, there are other comedians available. Fuck off. Who cares about your opinion in the fucking comments? Piss off, you little shit. And I'm not even you, John. So I got annoyed about that. I got annoyed about Keyboard Warriors and saw what you celebrity has to put up with. It's kind of like, fuck me. But the other thing that really annoyed me was that at the end it said John Richardson's show, Meet the Richardsons, is out. He's on tour at the moment and he has a podcast with Matt Ford about football and didn't mention us at all. So fuck
you. Oh, really?
Fuck you. I was in the comments going, this little shit doesn't know anything about how to promote the podcast that really matters. No, I didn't really, but you know.
I refer the learned gentleman again to ChatGPT, where I also asked, what do people say about the podcast, John Richardson and the Futurenauts? And do you know what ChatGPT said? It said, I'm sorry, I'm not aware of a podcast called John Richardson. He says, it's possible that the podcast is a new one or it's not well known enough to have caught my attention. Please let me know if there's anything else I can help you with.
Oh, it's very polite.
It's very polite.
Tell you what has happened this week. So last week, we kind of berated our listeners for sending in some questions that weren't quite up to scratch.
You did. I think Ed and I were very polite to our listeners and grateful for any feedback.
Well, I have to say, I think the listenership has taken it to heart because the questions this week are an absolute set of corkers.
Yeah? Where do you want to start then? There's some big old vegan meaty subjects to dive into.
Well, John, you are the host and I believe it is therefore your responsibility to guide the show. I mean, I don't want to tell any grandma to suck eggs, but isn't that your job?
Well... I went on the Davos, it's the Davros conference, isn't it, happening at the moment?
Freshers Week for CEOs.
Is that what you call it?
That's what we call it. I don't know. I've never been, so what do I know? But I know lots of people who have been. Mark, have you been?
No, I keep turning it down.
But yeah, it's that place where, because it's all the gathering of the elite, you get all the same shenanigans that you get at a Freshers Week, but just with very important people.
Yeah.
So, you know, you still get bouncers on the doors saying, you know, not tonight, mate, you're not on the list. And people queuing in corridors and everyone talking about how immensely brilliant and wealthy they are.
Yeah, I sort of have a mixed relationship because I know that I have friends that go and there's that argument with, like, if you're going to influence people, then you might as well go there, even if you don't like it. So I send other friends of mine, basically, and let them do it because I can't quite reconcile myself to it.
A friend of mine described it as like Turkmenistan, because obviously the World Economic Forum and the kind of Davos hosting has been all instigated by the same bloke for years. So it's a bit like one of these dictators who just won't let go of power, unlike Jacinda Ardern.
Oh, yeah. God, she's resigned this morning, isn't she? Well, kind of said she's leaving because she's burnt out. I like that honesty from her. I think that's really, really cool.
Yeah.
Yes, we were discussing that this morning. I mean, obviously, a novel idea that you resign when you think you're not doing the job well enough anymore. Really caught on globally, hasn't it?
What a refreshing change.
I went on their website this morning and I read a sentence that I think I'm going to struggle to eat. It really made me feel sick. So here we go. Because I tell you what it made me feel. We're always, and I mean we in the widest possible sense, the sort of the media in general and public perception here is very cynical about COP and those meetings. It made me realize those COP guys are not so bad. At least there's a very clear agenda there of what the aim is. There might be some cynicism in the people going there and they'll get together and agree something they know they're not going to do. But when you read sentences like, this morning at Davos, they discussed a crucial year to focus on adaptation. How can the climate COPs in Africa and the Middle East unlock scaled-up multi-stakeholder partnerships for adaptation with a particular focus on emerging and frontier markets? Mm. I mean, some of the things they're discussing, the $11 trillion opportunity in the care economy, enabling equitable transitions, the future of industrial policy, reigniting growth in Africa. It's so unashamedly financial. Mm. I guess that's at the very heart of what you're talking about, Mark. These things are going to happen anyway. They're either going to happen in secret without any sort of exposure and discussion of how things should be done, or we just get involved in it.
Well, the thing is, I've got nothing wrong with things being unashamedly financial if we put a value on everything. So if you actually had to pay for the cost or the externalities the way you did business, like the social cost of carbon has recently been estimated at about £200 per tonne. So for every tonne of carbon we put out, it's going to cost us £200 to clear up the mess. Now, if you factor that into businesses' costs and how they charge for things so that they would clear it up while they were doing it, then I have no problem with financial measures and saying there's an opportunity here to go and build a business that has the costs of the damage it does built in so it has to repair them. So there's nothing wrong necessarily with that kind of language. What's wrong is the underpinning kind of like, oh, we'll go and make a bunch of money, but there's a whole bunch of stuff we've not been asked to think about, which is kind of Kate Raper's whole argument really. Like, if you're going to run an economy properly, then you need to run the whole fucking economy. And that includes lots of things at the moment we think are unimportant to the economy, like a functioning ecosystem and social cohesion, because apparently those things are expensive. Well, it turns out they're not expensive. They're fucking essential, you stupid cunts. You're supposed to be business people. Can you not work this out?
I want to paraphrase Bill Hicks, that we mentioned last week. It's like, it's the end of the world dollar. It's the kind of apocalyptic Armageddon dollar. It's a huge market. It's a huge market.
Yeah. The end of the world is a big old market.
At this point, Mark, I'm going to apologise to the producer at CBBC that I asked to listen to this week's show with a view to John Richardson and Future Nuts do CBBS. Sort of calming children and their fears about the planet.
Yeah, putting the C-bomb into CBBS.
I mean, you said it so often. You've almost sort of single-handedly demystified the word. But I think we could have a character called Conte, who's just a big sort of fluffy financial advisor. Oh, here comes Mr. Cunt. I just wanted to have a conversation about how we could monetize this. Well, classic Cunt.
I was talking to one of my responsible leadership people yesterday who said, I was listening to your podcast in the car with my 13-year-old the other day when the whole section about butt plugs popped up. She goes, I didn't realize you went to that sort of territory. I said, to be fair, butt plugs was actually in the title of that episode. So it's not like you weren't forewarned. And she goes, oh, yes, but I didn't notice that in the car. I just pressed play.
And I remember that being a conversation about hygiene and maintenance of products.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Isn't that sanitation?
Indeed.
So before we move on from Davos, then, this to me is at the heart of what seems to be wrong with it. They're talking about the pandemic. And obviously, I'm not there, so one must not be guilty of reading a headline and drawing conclusions, but I'm going to do that. In a talk called 100 Days to Outrace the Next Pandemic, which to me is sort of almost hopeful that sort of idea that, because we've talked about it a lot, that the next pandemic is not 100 years away just because the last one was 100 years back, is potentially next week.
Yeah.
But the description of that is, creating safe and effective vaccines in 100 days is estimated to give economies and societies a chance of containing the next outbreak before it spreads. So there's no conversation about how we stop the next pandemic from happening. It's just saying, well, given that it's going to happen, how can we better fund medicines and things like that so we get the vaccines out faster? Which seems to be incredibly backward.
In its defense, that's where you might well apply sort of business innovation into that kind of stuff. And then we've got other people like the Diversity COP and all those other things trying to work out how we change the way we manage the planet. So I wouldn't necessarily be down on people trying to work out how to make vaccines faster. And in fact, that's something that a really good entrepreneur and some business innovation and financial innovation can do. And in fact, one of the great financial innovations that came out of the pandemic was this idea of advanced purchases, where you actually pay for the thing before you've even designed it. And that funded the research in order for us to go and make the vaccine. So that was like lots of people paying it forward. And that's quite interesting. There's a lot of talk about how we can do that with climate change. So there's lots of things we need to do to combat climate change. We can't afford them, apparently. But if we can pay for them in advance, the way you pay for a mortgage on a grand scale, then that's an interesting conversation.
Well, that's also assuming that it's going to be a virus next time around as well. I don't know. I've just been reading the reviews of that TV series, Last of Us. I don't know if you come across that, where it's not a virus, it's a fungus which has sort of jumped species. There's that classic zombie fungus.
The one that gets insects and makes them climb to the top of the tree.
Yeah, it gets ants and basically infiltrates their brain, controls their movements, makes them climb up, and then explodes all its spores out of their husk of a body to then go and infect other insects. And the premise of the series, really heartwarmingly, is what would happen if that fungus jumped species into humans.
Wow, goodness.
It's a lovely little moment. We had a little chat about Davos, and then we ended with Mark saying, well, let's not be too cynical and there are positives that will come out of this. And you've said, no, hang on, it might be a fungus and we might all turn into flesh-eating zombies. That's where I think this podcast does speak to 13-year-olds.
Yeah.
Because I've pretty much begged for those sort of things to happen.
Yeah. We still haven't got to any readers' questions yet, I've noticed.
No, well, I'm going to because I... What I think we share...
I'm so old there. I said readers, didn't I? Readers questions. Sorry, dear. I meant listeners' questions. This newfangled radio technology has rather misstepped me.
So one of the reasons I think this podcast does work is that the three of us get along. And one of the reasons I think we get along is that something we hear a lot when we speak to people, why don't you just fuck off? Now, thankfully, there is an answer to that question, which is because there's nowhere to fuck off to. And that brings us to Lucy's question. Thank you for the podcast. You give me hope, even in these bleak times. I'm sure you've heard the news regarding the regressive court ruling in favour of Alexander Darwell that prohibits wild camping on Dartmoor. I believe this is the only place in England wild camping has been allowed. It seems outrageous that the grotesque privilege of one man can have such a detrimental impact on the rest of the population. Surely access to what little nature we have left in this country should be promoted at every opportunity. The right to sleep under the stars is surely a human right. I'd love to hear your thoughts on right to roam, access to nature in England, and how it compares to other parts of the UK and the rest of the world. Look forward to the next episode. Love and Rage, Lucy. I like that end to an email with love and rage.
Yeah, that's very Extinction Rebellion.
Yeah, now this has got to be you, Ed, because you are total crusty.
I mean, it is. It's an outrageous decision. And I think you have to look at the likely incendiary effects it's going to have, because it is bonkers, particularly in the aftermath of the pandemic, where we all began to appreciate how limited actually our access to the shared common land of the UK is, which, let's not forget, historically was all enclosed against the will of the people into the hands of a relatively small number of landowners in the first place. But what happens, this is like the Kinder Scout mass trespass, which led to the foundation of the national parks, where workers from Manchester actually did the mass trespass onto the moorland in order to protest the fact that they were working in these miserable, polluted urban conditions and had a right to fresh air and exercise and to walk their land. And I think this is going to have the same shades, because it's the epitome of the clash between the haves and the have-nots, where you have someone of immense wealth and privilege who is probably largely also an absentee landlord who spends very little time on what is just one of his multiple estates. And what harm could possibly come to him, or an invasion of his privacy or his rights to enjoy his land, than the odd person camping under the stars to enjoy the perspective on the universe?
And I'm sure there's absolutely no link between his political donations to the MP of the local area that helped ratify this decision as well.
Of course. And if you go, I mean, you know, and Lucy says, well, what happens elsewhere? I mean, well, Scotland, there's a right to roam. And the thing is, with respect, a right to roam, to go and enjoy the land that we are stewards of, not absolute owners of, and to do that with respect to enjoy the nature and the common resources that we all share. And if you go abroad, I mean, I've spent quite a lot of time in Norway and Sweden. They call it Allemansrätten, which is a freedom to roam. It's really quite radical in Sweden. You can't go into someone's house or their immediate private garden, but you can pretty much camp within 70 meters of someone's house on their land, obviously allowing them to enjoy their right to privacy. But you can pretty much go anywhere and go fishing, kayaking, climbing, and everyone understands and shares that same belief. The UK is pretty miserable in this regard, it has to be said. And, you know, and I live in East Anglia, where there are a number of large farms where there are some footpaths. But I remember walking with an old hippie friend of my mum's like 30 years ago. And we were just walking along the edge of a field that had already been harvested. So it was post-harvest. There was no crop damage. And we were like right on the periphery. And we were halfway across and this Land Rover came roaring across the stubble. And this red-faced farmer said, do you realise you are on private property? And my mum's friend Dave, just, it was quite laconic, just sort of went, yeah, we were just wondering which bit of it you were using right now. and the guy had no answer to it. We were respectfully crossing his land, but we weren't interfering with anything. We weren't invading his privacy. We were miles from where his house was. And we were just traversing and enjoying the countryside and the nature. He just got increasingly red-faced and just kept repeating the fact that we were on private property and we should get off. But I think this is going to be one of those big moments where if the Kinder Scout mass trespass led to ultimately to the foundations of the national parks and the Pennine Way and some of the great walks that people now get to enjoy across the UK, then maybe this is another sort of boiling point moment where people are, no, this is outrageous, actually. We should have the right for respectful enjoyment.
I mean, I think it would be outrageous if a whole bunch of people decided to coordinate a campaign to sort of go out there and camp en masse. I mean, thousands and thousands of people did that. I mean, that's nothing I would endorse at all.
No, exactly. Well, I mean, the Right to Roam campaign, I mean, my old mate Nick Hayes, who actually, he's a brilliant artist and writer, he did the cover of my book, Only Planet. And he's a far more successful writer and campaigner than I am in many ways now, and also a beautiful artist. But him, he's been heavily involved in all of this. And maybe we should get him on the podcast one day. But he's incredibly articulate on this topic. And in his bestseller, The Book of Trespass, it's wonderful because every chapter is basically him going and trespassing on a particular estate. And he writes about the history of each estate, how it was put together, you know, often with connections back to slave plantations in the Caribbean and all the dirty sugar money that enabled these estates to be built. And he just goes for a little wild camp on each one. And sometimes he gets apprehended by gamekeepers, other times he gets away with it. But I think the whole point that he's making is it's not putting anyone out if you do it with the right level of respect.
Yeah, ownership of land in itself is back to basics conversation about what does it mean to own land. It feels like this has been sort of drip-fed over the last few years by a perhaps over-reporting of those who wild camp and perhaps don't look after the land. I've got family in the Lake District, and obviously you do stumble across people who've left disposable, well, there's no such thing as a disposable tent, but what is seen as a disposable tent and food waste and things like that. And that feels like perhaps right-minded people's fury at people not looking after the land has been weaponized to say, well, look, actually, this is a threat to the very existence of well-maintained and well-looked-after wildlife reserves. And that actually, it's just such a drop in the ocean compared to the number of people who would benefit. And what we discuss so much on this podcast is healthcare versus sick care, what the benefit to our society is of people being able to walk and camp and experience nature. And we're very good at discussing economy in some ways, but not in what is the benefit to the economy of that healthy population and that population that feels a connection to the planet it lives on and is trying to save.
And it's such a minuscule percentage of England in particular that is accessible. And that includes rivers. You know, when I say I live on a river, but the upper reach of the Chet is arguably private. When I go up there in my little rowboat, but people technically aren't supposed to. And a lot of this law is untested and unproven. It becomes really, really complicated because river owners or landowners adjacent to rivers claim that they own the river to the halfway point. But then others will argue that because the law hasn't been proven in a kind of national sense, that actually the rights of navigation go back to Magna Carta, when rivers were absolutely key arterial routes and mechanisms of transport and movement. And so everyone should have the right to navigate any river in any craft that can navigate it, whether it's a canoe or a stand-up paddleboard.
Yeah, and the idea is if you're going to say you own it, then you better bloody look after it and maintain it in terms of a functioning ecosystem. And a lot of landowners don't do that. So fuck you, you can't have it. And then not take responsibility for it.
Yeah. You know?
What? No, I'm not going to do it.
Oh, good. Putting
the cunt into country landowners.
There we go. There's a fantastic section in the most recent Alan Partridge audiobook. I don't know if you've heard it, where he goes for a wild swim and is confronted by a landowner and argues that he's actually not touching land because he's floating within the water, which is passing through the land. Gets into some difficulty and the water gets tangled up in a reed bed. It's very funny. So the next question is, last week we had a conversation about who our best listener is. You're welcome to join in that debate. Put your case. Something happened this week that changed Mark's mood. and that led Mark to say that the listener questions this week have been particularly good. And I would put it to you that it's the words of Richard in South Yorkshire that have changed Mark's mindset. Dear John, Mark and Ed, after being drip-fed the merits of prog rock by Mark over four series of the Future Noughts, my resistance finally broke and I found myself secretly dabbling with the musical genre, which as a 57-year-old, I probably should have explored more in the 70s and the 80s.
When I was Sean Connery.
Yeah. I began a dalliance with Quantum Pig and was pleasantly surprised that it was not shit. In fact, I rather enjoyed it and in no time at all found myself romping with Jethro Tull, flirting with Floyd, saying yes to yes, and inseminating myself with a bit of Rush. Now I think I might be pregnant. My question is, he's clearly taken the pun search as well. It's a bold application for best listener. He loves the prog. He loves a pun. He wants a prognosis on the future for his prog progeny. Kind regards, Richard in South Yorkshire.
Well, I mean, that's actually not the letter that came this week that cheered me up the most, because there's another one which we'll come to later. But Richard, welcome. You're very welcome here. And on the 8th of February, Quantum Pig will be supporting Lonely Robot at the Islington Town Halls in London. If you're nearby, you should enjoy that. At the end of the day, everybody comes to prog in the end. 57 is late, but you've still got a good 20 years probably to really, really enjoy yourself. So go for it. Get naked, get lubed, get progged. Go for the full immersion.
I have to say, I also asked ChatGPT about Quantum Pig.
Mm-hmm. Let me guess what it said. It said, I am not aware of Quantum Pig.
Well, I said, are Quantum Pig any good? And it came back saying, I am not familiar with any specific entity called Quantum Pig. Yeah. So then I said, are the prog rock band Quantum Pig any good? And it says, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with a prog rock band called Quantum Pig. I may not be aware of bands formed after 2021. And even if I know a band, the question of if a band is good is a matter of personal taste.
Yes. No, everybody comes to prog in the end. It's interesting. People sort of listen to it and they kind of go, oh, it's actually quite good. Oh, I quite like it. Oh, it's not weird. Oh, it's kind of a mix of all sorts of different things. Oh, it's kind of progressive. Oh, sorry for my prejudice. I mean, check it out.
I realised you didn't intend that as a punchline. I was picturing at any point in my life me having the self-awareness and compassion to say, hey, sorry for my prejudice. There's a lot of growth needed in me before I'm at that point. So let's get on to the email that was Mark's favourite, and it comes from George Brown. I'm going to read his penultimate sentence first. Apologies for the essay. So my apologies to you, George, for clipping somewhat your comments. But George says, a thank you off the top for creating what very quickly became my all-time favourite podcast, as inspiring it is, informative, engaging, depressing, and uplifting. And I particularly love the C word. He doesn't say that. It's sort of implied, isn't it? A few weeks ago, I was able to join Mark and Ed at The Conduit for their brilliant talk on technology. I was predictably mesmerized. I mean, this is nothing but a full-out application for favorite listener, this, isn't it? Mesmerized by the Future Noughts.
He's fluffing us right now, isn't he?
Oh, we've moved beyond fluffing now. Helped by my inadvertent positioning in the middle of the front row, it was a truly inspiring experience, if only missing John's golden thread of witty mediation.
The golden thread.
Do you see what he said there? He said, it was really good except for the absence of wit.
A few days after your talk, I went to an excellent lecture at Imperial by your friend, the wonderful Brian Eno, who said revolutions rise after two trends. Firstly, when everyone realizes something is wrong, and secondly, when everyone realizes that everyone else has realized. This untapped potential frequently plays on my mind, knowing that if everybody who fundamentally opposed a profit over planet ethos at this very moment simultaneously stood as one, we could see a major political shift overnight. To me, it seems the true struggle lies in coordination within systems designed to limit our own vision of how to unite and collectively demand better alternatives in an economy increasingly driven by competition for our attention. To that end, I have a proposal for you.
He's good, isn't he?
He's very good.
I tell you what I also like about George, because he's very thoughtful and he's speaking our language. Also, there's a lot of content, which means we don't have to do so much work, because now we've got listeners literally providing the actual content now. It's like indentured labor.
People unite.
Well, Mark, you always say humanity is a co-inspirational network, and now George is co-inspiring us.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, George.
If all the people who thought that this podcast would be better if the listeners did it themselves got together and made their own podcast. Series 5 is called Not John Richardson and Not the Future Notes. Do the work for your fucking selves. So his proposal, I mean, at this point in the email, sounds like it's going to be an actual marriage proposal. It's not. He says, the thought I had was to create a young Future Notes network where supporters of the show have a space to share ideas and comments about the relevant topics you discuss.
Oh. Yeah, we have to edit all the C-bombs out first, though, don't we?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we've already had that problem with school listening.
Well, I think that's a fabulous idea. I mean, I'm upset by the the use of the word young, the young Future Notes, because that immediately makes Ed and I feel like we're fucking ancient.
We are.
He does reference that. He says it wouldn't have to be just for the young if that's exclusive. It just felt apt that young aspiring change makers might lead the discussion when talking about creating the future that younger generations will inherit.
Do you know what? I'd be very interested to talk to George if you wanted to think about that, because years ago I set up something called the League of Pragmatic Optimists, which was a bunch of people who got together in the back rooms of pubs in various cities and kind of tried to work out how to help each other solve local and indeed complex problems. And some notable successes came out of that. And it kind of fizzled because of, I guess, there were enough people, because I didn't have the bandwidth as a Z-list celeb then. And also we didn't get much funding. But I think now you could imagine like a Future Noughts League of Pragmatic Optimists actually coming together and spreading the vibe of the show, which some of our listeners seem to like, actually into a more day-to-day meet once a month in your local pub, try and solve your local and your global problems and have a laugh in the spirit that we try and do, which is kind of some optimism, some fun in the direction of hope. I think it's an absolutely fantastic idea. And if George wanted to dedicate some time to that, we could probably try and find some funding and get it off the ground.
How do you think that would work in terms of maintaining positivity? Because obviously I work alongside, I don't know if listeners know this, I do another podcast. I like to promote it in newspapers up and down the land.
Yeah.
But Matt Ford's main job is his political party podcast, which exists to basically interview people across the political spectrum with the ethos that we are stronger when we speak with compassion with each other and we understand why somebody has come to their worldview and how we can help learn from them and shape their opinions towards our own. And broadly, we don't speak very nicely to each other at the moment. And there's another movement, Andy's Man Club, which I've supported in the past, which is about men coming together and being able to speak only when they wish to. If you were to put together a group of people in any city or town in that spirit of let's come together and be together, even people who probably are all would describe themselves as progressive and compassionate about the future, I sort of feel like that would tend towards arguments, especially in a pub, more often than it would end in a sort of collegiate hugging atmosphere.
That's where you're wrong, John. That's absolutely where you're
wrong. I'm glad to hear it.
So, I mean, I'm also thinking about the work that John Alexander has been doing, but when we ran the League of Pragmatic Optimists, they were the most joyous events. You had people from all different backgrounds. And one of the things was there, like, what are we going to fix together? What's the problem? And you get people with diverse, and you're going to, actually, your diverse views are absolutely essential to solving this problem, because the more diverse a set of views, the better the solutions come out. All the research says that innovation and diversity go hand in hand. So if you set the tone right and you set the principles right, then actually people go, God, that was incredibly life-affirming. And I got to have a pint and I made a few friends. And in fact, there were a couple of marriages that came out of the League of Pragmatic Optimists as well, which I was quite happy about. So you might even get to get your rocks off as well.
I might.
Yeah, aren't you married?
Well, I am at the moment, but you know.
Love that at the moment. That's very, very insightful.
Well, what I didn't read is the prog email, which says, could you get any tips on single parenting? Because my wife thinks prog is shit. we're all in a state of flux. Go on, Ed.
I think Mark's right. And like my good friend Mikey Winecove runs a thing called The People Speak, which has always been about radical participation. He's been doing it for like 25 years. And he has a couple of models which he's used relentlessly to glorious effect. And one is called Talkie-Oki, which is essentially a sort of round table with him or an adjudicator, mediator, sort of sat in the center. And it feels like a game show. You plonk it in a public space. He used to do it outside the BFI on the South Bank in London. I'll take it to festivals. But basically, anyone can walk up and start a conversation about anything. There's only two rules: no singing and no punch-ups.
And no good for pirates, then, is it?
No, talkie okie, no good for pirates. But they've got an incredible archive now. They've had these discussions all over the country. The desire to have a discourse with other people who aren't necessarily from the same walk of life of you is incredibly powerful and intriguing. And I remember being in Copenhagen with him at a conference, and we set up the talkie okie table in the lobby of the hotel in Copenhagen. And we just had various different hotel guests just sort of wandering over going, what on earth's going on over here? And having this incredible conversation. And then he developed another format, which was called Who Wants to Be, but it wasn't about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Basically, they would hold a public event in a theater. Everyone would pay their tenner to get in. And then you'd take the whole pot of tenners, which would be several hundred, even a couple of thousand quid. And then people would basically pitch ideas of what they might collectively spend that on. And people would bid, and then the people would vote until you got it down to one idea. But again, it wasn't consensus. It was a bit like what we were saying last week. It was sociocracy in action, because eventually you got to an idea that people went, all right, it wasn't my idea, but I'm happy to go with that one. I'm not going to block it. And they used to do brilliant things. Sometimes they would take it all back to the bar and have it as a tab for everyone to have drinks. Other times they would invest it into creating a new park bench around the corner, or a bit of public infrastructure. You know, it was really creative. And again, it was participatory democracy or sociocracy in action.
Yeah, I mean, one of the principles of the League of Pragmatic Optimists was pretty much people divided by politics are very soon brought together around projects.
Yeah.
You give people something to build together and bring their unique and different worldviews to, in the sense of like, we need to build this. People go, oh, great. Yeah, well, let's get on with that then. You find actually a lot of their supposed differences disappear and they become common humans in the service of something good. It's when what politicians and ideologues try to do is they try to say, look, your desire for a health centre is at odds with that person's desire for street lighting. And that's not true. We want both. And actually, if you work together to get both of them and work out how we do it, that's very essence of participatory budgeting, for instance, then you find greater social cohesion, greater engagement with institutions who facilitate this stuff because they now trust the government. It's very much the Taiwanese model of like, people trust the government trusts the people, and we all trust each other to self-organise in our diversity and difference. You know, it's not saying everybody gets along. Nobody's saying that. It's saying like, how do we take all these different views and make them into something that kind of works pretty well for all of us? I mean, that's the very basis of society, for God's sake. We're a collaborative species. Otherwise, we wouldn't have things like houses and computers and podcasts and all that kind of stuff. We're massively collaborative. And what politics tries to do is tell us that we're not, and you have to choose one side or another. And we all think it's bullshit. And back to the point, if we all just stood up and went, you know what, I'm fed up with this. And I think Brian Eno is right. I've been sitting with Brian quite a lot recently, and he said the same thing to me in private, you know, that moment where the revolution is now getting to that point where not only do you know that it's wrong, but you're beginning to realize that everybody else knows that it's wrong. And I think, for instance, this thing we talked about at the beginning of the show with the right to ramble thing, it doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. And actually, I hate the whole idea of being on a fucking political spectrum. It's just like, that's just bullshit. And actually, I think it's bullshit. And we're all going to say it's bullshit. So maybe this mass camping out on his land will be one of those flashpoints where we've all realised it's wrong, and we've realised that everybody else realises it wrong. And yes, at that point, the Future Nauts League of Pragmatic Optimists Club is exactly what we need.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a bloody good pitch for what Series 5 of this podcast might be.
Just going around all the different clubs, doing them live from each pub in a different, you know, we're with Future Nauts Pragmatic Optimists in Leeds, and then we're in Bristol, and then we're in the Azores.
Yeah.
And then the Maldives.
In the Azores?
Just thinking of places I'd like to go.
Let's get George in. Let's have a good chat about how we set up that network. And let's have a think about whether we can get out and about a bit for Series 5. And of course, we've talked about Davos and financial markets. Let's talk about how we then transfer Series 5 to a really lucrative TV series. Right, guys?
I think that's an oxymoron, isn't it?
Lucrative TV series.
Nowadays, I mean, if you try and get anything done on TV, particularly in Britain, you've got a whole bunch of so-called creators who'll take your idea, totally fuck with it, make it completely useless, show it to an audience who goes, that's fucking useless, advertise some shit around it, you get blamed for it, and three series later it's in the toilet. It's generally been my experience of TV, but you know, I'm not as successful as you, John, so that probably says something about the two of us.
Well, it's a lovely point for me to thank you for listening and say Odd Couples is on Channel 4 this Friday at 9 o'clock. You can catch the new series of Meet the Richardsons from March on Dave. That's my week. We have to, and I'm always fascinated to know what you two are up to during the week. So, Mark and Ed, where do we find you in the next few days?
I'm literally off to have a meeting with Client Earth right now. Then I'm off to the small beer company to talk to them about creating the world's first regenerative beer.
Ooh.
Well, that makes you stronger.
I don't think I'll ever do that. And then, yeah, just carry on building this carbon removals business, which is going through the roof, as I keep saying. So we're trying to keep sane. And I'm going to try and go to the gym a bit more and get my fitness regime back onto some kind of more regular footing. Also, it is both my son's birthday and my wife's birthday all in quick succession. So I got a lot of cake to eat.
Good.
Isn't that the title of John's new show?
Oh, yeah. Cake.
Eat the cake.
Eat the cake with Oki and Oki.
Well, well, I've literally got the environment agency knocking on my door. I've just had to jump up and wave at them and say, I'll just be 2 minutes.
Oh, well, join us next week for an update on the log.
I did ask, of course, you get the theme of my research this week. So I did also ask ChatGPT, how do I remove a log from my sluice? It actually gave a really good answer.
Well, there you go. It's a relief to know that tech that doesn't know we exist or like any of the things that we put out into the world at least knows how to shift a log.
Yeah, exactly. I would say, got much better response from ChatGPT than we did from the listeners. Well, I did the call out last week. I was expecting at least a few suggestions, but like it was total tumbleweed.
But it doesn't know how to move a log. It knows how to aggregate previous bits of text in a way that says this has been explained these ways before. This seems so. It doesn't know at all because it doesn't live. It doesn't exist. It has no.
Okay.
You know, Nick Cave was sent a whole bunch of ChatGPT lyrics in the style of Nick Cave. And he did this amazing tirade against, you know, this fucking machine doesn't know how to write a song because it's never fucking suffered. It doesn't know anything. Doesn't have an opinion on anything. It's not intelligent, but it is very useful. And people need to fucking realize that it's not intelligent and stop calling it that.
I am prepared to suffer to move the log from my sluice.
Mm. And then you can write a song about it or a poem about it. And I will have to suffer reading it.
I will write a poem about it.
Yeah, say, I will have to suffer then.
Yeah. I think what's happened there is that you've confused Nick Cave's response with the Guardian comments that you read underneath my Q&A. Yeah. It's not intelligent, it hasn't suffered, and people need to stop fucking pretending it has.
I've done the first three verses of There's a Log in My Sluice. Do you want to hear them? Awakened by the river's roar, I've got to do it in the Scottish accent. Awakened by the river's roar, a rumbling beneath my floor, the rushing, gushing force of water suggests to me I really ought to investigate what's up below that's changed the gentle river's flow. Under the deck it's all revealed, something large, almost concealed, lurks within the frothing torrent, its presence painfully abhorrent. Finally I can deduce there's a feckin' log stuck in my sluice. What can I do to shift this tree, unleash the current to be free? Its massive girth will take some shifting, its hefty weight will take some lifting. It's going to be hard to prise it loose, this colossal log stuck in my sluice.
Well, I'm sorry I didn't get to say goodbye to our Scottish listeners before that, but hopefully they'll come back next week. It's very good. I look forward to hearing the full version.
I don't think you're a poet. I think you're more kind of like a limerick writer. I think you're kind of a cross between James Lovelock and Billy Connolly.
With a bit of Ivor Cutler.
Yeah, you're a Billy Lovelock.
I would take that. That's the nicest thing he said. What's happened with these podcasts, this series, is Mark joins an absolute stink. And just as we're getting going and he's being nice to us, it's time to end. So I feel like we're basically fluffing you. So whoever you have a meeting with after you talk to us gets the very best of you. Thank you for your time. It's been greatly enjoyable. The listener emails really are fantastic. So keep those coming in and continue your application to be our best listener. A strong play made by George this week. And we had a winner last week.
I wonder if we should invite best listener onto a show at some point. We get the award. We can actually.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perhaps when the log comes loose, you could carve something from it.
Yes, exactly. I'll sculpt something as a kind of memento.
It feels apt that the reward for listening to this show should be a sluice log that's been gone at with an axe. We'll see you very soon. Thank you for your company. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Ed.
Cheerio.